appeared in the Toronto Globe and Mail on April 22nd, 2023. And for now, that's it. Thank you for joining us. You've been listening to Free Culture Radio. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. I thank my guest, Hilary Agro. Many thanks to everyone out there fighting for civil rights, human rights, and social justice. And thanks especially to you, dear listener, for your support. You make it all worth it. We'll be back in a month to continue our examination of drugs, drug cultures, and the influence of drugs on society. Thanks again for listening. This is Dr. Fay saying so long. So long.
Listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
Tune in tomorrow at 8 in the morning for our premiere of our new weekly Thursday talk show, Keeping It Real with Lisa Loving. Her guest will be Joanne Hardesty, former Portland City Commissioner, tomorrow at 8 in the morning here on KBOO 90.7 FM Portland.
Be sure to tune in to Radio Lost and Found. It's the show that puts the OO in KBOO. Radio Lost and Found is a two-hour media escape of found sounds, forgotten records, outre recordings, and more. Coming to you every second and fourth Thursday from 10 to midnight, right here on KBOO.
Howdy, everybody. I'm Rose Maddox, and I'd like to tell you that you're listening to KBOO in Portland, Oregon, the station that I listen to when I'm in the area.
Hey, everybody. Thanks again for tuning in to Culture in Motion. I just want to let you guys know, webinar with protesters at the G7 summit in Hiroshima, Japan. This is going to be happening Friday, May 19th at 7 p.m. EST, 6 p.m. CST, 4 p.m. PST, U.S. out of the Asia Pacific. There's going to be a registered link on my personal Facebook page, Michael Crenshaw. If you follow me, you can register for that webinar. The organization is UNAC, United National Anti-War Coalition. The G7 countries, the United States, Canada, United Kingdom, France, Germany, Italy, and Japan, with the EU observer status. All these countries represent the biggest Western economies. They will be meeting this month in, of all places, Hiroshima, Japan. We can be sure that high on their agenda will be financing more killing and war in Ukraine. Ironically, they chose to meet in Hiroshima, where the U.S. dropped the first nuclear bomb on people. Today, the war in Ukraine brings us ever closer to a nuclear war that could destroy the planet and everyone on it. Additionally, sanctions, many tied to the Ukraine war, have brought countries together to resist this attack on their economies and people. Alternative banking, trade, and economic institutions are coming together and are challenging U.S. and Western hegemony. The G7 meeting in Japan comes at a time that the U.S. is threatening China and moving more forces and bases to Asia. At the last NATO summit in Madrid, they decided that NATO should become a worldwide military alliance with Russia and China as its main targets. Progressive forces will be protesting the G7 in Japan, calling for an end to their wars and economic bullying. There will be protest marches and an alternative summit meeting. The UNAC Administrative Committee member and spokesperson for the Filipino Alliance, Bayan USA, Rhonda Romero, will be present along with other people from the U.S. and from many other countries. UNAC will be holding their webinar with some of the people at the protest to report on it and discuss the G7 and increase U.S. and NATO militarization in the Asia Pacific region. Please mention that it will be, and I want to let you guys know that it will be a collaboration between the United National Anti-War Coalition and the Resist U.S. Less War Movement. And I wanted to say before we bring our guests on, Malcolm Shabazz Hoover and Donnell Alexander, that Donnell has a book coming out soon, in a month or so, called Protest City. So he'll be our second guest. And that book is going to be about protest culture in the years of George Floyd and the years that follow, and protest culture in the streets in Portland. Thank you for tuning in, and I hope you enjoy today's show. Good morning, good evening, good afternoon, wherever you're at on earth, whether you're tuned in to KBOO.FM on the web or Cable Community Radio 90.7 on the FM dial in Portland, Oregon. This is Culture in Motion, twice monthly show where we talk about music, culture, politics, activism, and the connection and intersection. I'm your host, Mike Crenshaw. Today we have a special guest, Malcolm Hoover. What's good, Malcolm?
Yo!
So we've had Malcolm on before. Malcolm is a co-founder of the Black Futures Farm, along with his partner, Mirabai. And they do a lot of work for Black food sovereignty in the Northwest. And there's another project called Crenshaw and Shabazz, or Crenshaw Shabazz and the homie Tom, or the MFs. We gotta talk all about that today. Malcolm, how you doing this morning?
I'm blessed and highly favored, man. Everything's good. I'm in Springfield right now. My wife, Mirabai Collins, who is not just my wife, but like you mentioned, she's my co-director and co-founder of Black Futures Farm. She is down here getting, she's at U of O enrolled as a graduate student, getting her master's in environmental studies. And so I'm down here, you know, hanging out with my wife, and life is beautiful. I'm happy to be alive.
That's what's up. So food sovereignty, you know, environmental, what you said, environmental studies.
Mm-hmm.
So you guys are basically not only current, you're kind of ahead of the curve a little bit.
Black futures,
right?
Yeah. You know, Mirabai is probably one of the smartest people I've ever met in my life. And so we met doing volunteer work for Mudbone Grown Art and Shante. Mm-hmm. and doing community work. And we had a group in conjunction with some other people called We Grow PDX, which was a collection of Black growers. And we collected every Sunday. It was the genesis of Black Sunday at Black Futures Farm and out of 60th and Northeast Simpson. And we had a little half acre out there where we grew food together. excuse me. Also, Happiness Family Farms was out there, Rosada and Prosper. And, you know, Mirabai has always just been this brilliant, amazing person. And so she decided that she wanted to, like, deepen her practice and, you know, as not just as an agriculturalist, as an environmentalist, but also as a writer and a thinker. And so this program here at U of O had kind of all the pieces that she had been looking for. And so she's here. She's doing really well as a grad student. She's almost halfway through her program. But it's strange because we have to co-locate. And so she comes up, I come down. Yeah, she's doing great. And I'm just trying to do the best I can to support her.
That's what's up. So this project that I mentioned earlier, you know, it has a couple of different names. At first it was going to be Malcolm's Ride, then it was going to be Mike and Malcolm's Ride. Currently it's Crenshaw and Shabazz, and then we added
the homie Tom
taking on there. The genesis of this idea, where did it come from, and how long has it been kind of swirling around in your imagination?
Yeah, almost 10 years, man. I say the genesis came like when I got my first bike. So I used to have a Honda Shadow 750 Ace. I got it like 10 years ago, but I didn't actually start riding it until like maybe 2 years after I bought it. It just kind of sat in my backyard in Oakland. And I always wanted to ride a motorcycle. And just, you know, originally I'm from East Palo Alto, California, which is home of Soul Brothers MC. And always saw these cats on Harleys, man, just like, you know, riding and with the music on the bikes and, you know, these highly customized bikes. And, you know, there were just these dudes, and I just really loved the way they carried themselves, you know, like, and how they were just so free. And in the spirit that they displayed with each other, the way that they were with one another and the way that they showed up in community, which is something I really admired. And, you know, they were hanging out with the Panthers and the Pan-Africanists, and, you know, just the way that they were is something that I love. And so when I got my bike, you know, I didn't think I was going to be in Soul Brothers or anything like that. But when I got my bike, I just wanted to have that same sense of freedom. And so, you know, my first bike is called Liberation, and it was red, black, and green, had a red star on it, on the tank. And I was like, man, this is beautiful. And just the bike, because it was like a, you know, rattle can, and had little mini apes on it. It was a really unique looking little bike. And people were always asking me questions about it. I think people were just thrilled, you know, that I was just out just mashing around and just happy. And so that joy, I think, translated into, like, I always want to talk to people. So I would just start having these beautiful conversations, man. I was living in Oakland at the time, and people were just opening up to me, people who I would never have talked to. And I never had the opportunity to talk to if it hadn't been for that motorcycle, because I wouldn't have had anything in common with them. So like on Market Street in San Francisco, there's a couple places where people park their bikes, and it'll be like 100 bikes out there, you know, and everybody comes in the morning, they park their bike, and then they might spend 20 minutes or a half hour just drinking coffee with each other, talking. And then in the evening time, all those people show up and they do it again, and they roll out. And I got to be a part of that a couple times, and I was like, man, this is great. Like, I want to do this everywhere. I want to have these kind of conversations everywhere with people, and then I want to share them. And so that was really the genesis of the idea, which is me popping around the Bay. You know, like, I went all over. I went all over the Bay. I was in Livermore, Santa Cruz, Salinas, which is not really the Bay Area. Marin County. Where else did I go? Just everywhere. And, you know, everywhere I went, I would have conversations with other cats on motorcycles. And you know how it goes. We just start talking and people open up, and you and people were just revealed their humanity. And I was able to reveal mine. And as somebody who's been doing anti-racist work and education for, you know, the bulk of my life since I was 16 or 17, I have not found a greater tool other than like outright conflict that got people to open up, you know? So I just think it's a great platform to have the conversations. Even if people don't ride motorcycles, you know, they like them, or it provides an opening to talk, a safe space to which to open into a conversation. And so that was the genesis of the idea. I was like, this is a really good tool to build conversations around. What would it look like if I took this motorcycle and like a GoPro camera and just went to cafes and put up a little sign and said, hey, can we talk? Can I buy a piece of pie or something like that? And then I recorded those conversations. That's what I originally saw it as. Like, I was going to pull up to mom and pops, you know, cafes and diners and stuff, and sit there with the little sandwich board, you know, and just offer to buy people a meal in exchange for their time, and then put that on YouTube. And now it's blossomed into this thing where there's, you know, three of us riding, and we have a camera crew, and now we have a director, and yeah, I think it's going to be great. It's a little is simultaneously intimidating and wonderful at the same time, you know, because I don't want it to be, I want it to be authentic, you know. In order for it to be powerful, it has to be authentic and based in reality. I don't want it to be some weird, contrived reality show BS. And I also don't want it to be boring, but I'm not a boring person. You're not a boring person. Tom is the opposite of boring. So I'm pretty sure it's going to be fine.
Shout out to Tom Tegner.
Yeah, shout out
to Tom. Homie Tom. So just, you know, to give everybody a synopsis, if you're just tuning in, this is Culture in Motion. I'm talking to Malcolm Shabazz Hoover. I'm the host, you know, Mike Crenshaw. We're talking about this project called Crenshaw and Shabazz. And you can find out more about the project if you go to GoFundMe.com. If you search Crenshaw and Shabazz, it should come up. C-R-E-N-S-H-A-W ampersand Shabazz, S-H-A-B-A-Z-Z. The project involves us riding our motorcycles across the country and having conversations. I think we're going to be putting race forward in our conversations. We're going to talk about all kinds of things, the common things that we have, the things that we have in common as people and citizens, migrants, anybody that we encounter. We're going to talk about a lot of different things, but we want to talk a lot about race. We want to talk about the current times, our history, and have fun on the bikes. So yeah, check it out, Crenshaw and Shabazz. Malcolm, you said something I want to explore a little bit. You said intimidating and what'd you say, exciting?
Yeah.
Well, what do you mean by that?
I mean, I've never done anything like this, you know? I've been on TV before. I've like hosted some things in the 90s and early 2000s. I spent a lot of time in front of a camera. You know, I was like in a documentary about Tupac a million years ago. But I've never been the center of anything like this. And you know, it's a dream. It's my dream. So in that way, it's wonderful. Like, this is my dream coming true in a lot of ways, because it's the culmination of many things that are super important to me and I center in my life. So centering a conversation around liberation, because this is the thing. When we talk about racism in America, we often center our victim status. You know, how we have been harmed, the harm that racism has done, the power of white supremacy asserts over our lives, the way that it impacts us negatively. I want to change that dialogue to not center on the harm that it does, which is common knowledge at this point, or should be. What I want to center is how have we served ourselves by liberating ourselves from white supremacy? How have communities changed that dynamic inwardly and outwardly? How have people created places for themselves where they can thrive, even in the midst of great oppression? And I think that conversation is a conversation that needs to be advanced. We give white supremacy too much power by always talking about how white power asserts control over our lives. We are in control of our lives. We have agency. It is important for us to assert our agency and our power in this world. And I think the more that we can share how we have asserted our power, the more people will learn to do it for themselves and want to do it. So I want this to serve not as just a way of having difficult conversations, right? Like, hey, I saw Crenshaw Shabazz. Now I work with a guy. And now, because I think he watches that too, or I can ask him if he watches it, you know, maybe I can now have that conversation with this person that I've been intimidated about and I didn't want to have. And then also maybe I can learn how people in Portland have created this movement around Black farming, right? And maybe I can get together with some people in my community and start a farm and grow food and give food away and feed my neighbors. It's not that intimidating because these dudes did it. You know, these folks did it and I didn't know anything about farming. You know, 7 years ago, I knew nothing. I didn't even know how to plant a thing properly. I was killing collard green plants, pulling a whole plant out the ground to harvest it. You know, I didn't know anything. And now I still don't know a lot, but I know more than I did. And I know enough to teach other people, you know, some of the basics and get them started, you know? So I'm really grateful for that. And I just want to share those things. So, you know, that's what I kind of say. It's wonderful, intimidating. I want this to be something that is shared widely, that people enjoy, that they're entertained by, that they learn from. You know, years ago, Chris had that concept, edutainment. Karis one had the concept edutainment. So, you know, I really want to get into that. Not so much the education part, I mean the entertainment part, but the education. You know, how can we share these lessons and do it in a way that's natural and easy and good for everybody?
Yeah, that was you said a lot. And I think one of the things that's the most powerful, thought-provoking and profound is the humility of your statement. I sense that this isn't just about self-promotion. You know, you're having fun, you're living your dream, you're engaged in a project that you're very passionate about, yet the character of the project is way bigger than you. And the conversations that we're going to have with people, it's not just about us expressing our points of view. You know, one of the things about a dialogue is that when we engage in conversations with people, some of whom are gonna be people we're already in community with, some of whom are gonna be strangers, and you share space, we're gonna encounter ideas that aren't just our own, mm-hmm. as well as ideas that we share with other folks. So motorcycles are dangerous. America is a dangerous place. People ask me, well, you're going to be talking about race at a time where racial tension is high. We just had the KKK khaki march in Washington for Law Enforcement Week or whatever. You know, that's Jesus Christ. So what do you have to say to people who have concerns about your safety, about the safety of the project, and that you're going to have Black men and the homie Tom? No stranger to conflict, but you're going to have people engaging in these conversations that could put us in very vulnerable places.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a Black man in America. I'm a middle-aged Black man in America. You know, there are very few times in my life where I can say I felt 100% safe. And so I think part of the... you know, part of the cost of living in the skin, in the place that we live in, the time that we live in, is there's, you know, and I'm dark. I'm a dark-skinned Black person. I'm not, like, I'm always conspicuous. Unless I'm around a whole bunch of other dark-skinned Black people, I'm usually the darkest person in the room. And I'm used to standing out, and I've always been who I am. I've always been vocal about racism. Cannot count the amount of physical conflicts I've been in around these issues. So I'm not afraid, is what I'm saying. Like, I'm not afraid, you know, like, yeah, some people are going to act crazy, but we're also going to have cameras with us. Not that cameras stop racists from killing people or hurting people, but bye, babe.
Love you.
Love you too. It's my wife saying bye. Not that, let me go back. So I always feel like under some level of threat. You know, it's a thing that I live with. I've taken I do a lot of praying. I think I'm always walking with, I know that I'm always walking with my ancestors and I'm protected, you know? So not that I'm bulletproof or like invulnerable. I'm not the Hulk out this mug, but you know, like I also feel a certain level of protection. And I just, I guess I know what I'm doing. I know that I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing. And so as long as I'm in alignment with my purpose, I'm protected. That's how I feel. And so my dad has always said, faith and fear cannot live in the same house. And I have an incredible amount of faith around this project. And I think my life path in general, and I cannot allow myself to be afraid, and so afraid that I don't keep walking forward in my purpose. You know, like,
yeah, that's powerful. Thank you for sharing. That's powerful. Thank you for sharing that. I think that this project is far reaching. The first leg of our journey is going to be going from Portland, Oregon, slated to leave June 22nd, down to Silverado, California, which is in the Los Angeles area, for the Born Free Custom Motorcycle Show. I've been wanting to take that journey for a number of years, looking at Born Free on Instagram, looking at all the beautiful custom motorcycles. So to be able to do it as part of the show, we get to share that experience with the world. The trip to LA and back is going to be a significant part of the first episode of the show. We'll come back and edit and share it with people. But in the future, you know, we plan to shoot a whole season. And in the future, one of the things we're going to do is, and this was your idea, Malcolm, go down south.
Mm-hmm.
Talk to the people in the places that our ancestors might have been held captive. I just talked to the Black folks down there. Talk to some of the white folks who might have been responsible for holding our folks in captivity.
Mm-hmm.
Talk to some Native American people who have been around before either of us and our ancestors were, you know, on this land, that are still here surviving white supremacy and capitalism. Tell us more about that.
Yeah. So I'm a Hoover. My family's last name is Hoover, among other names. Hoover, Friday, Rhine are the main names of my dad's side. And then my mom is a DeBow and a Bass. And if you go down, the Bass family is huge. But if you go down to Gastonia, Gaston County, North Carolina, or you go to Winston-Salem, or you go to Charlotte, you're going to see those names everywhere. You'll see Friday, Rhine, Hoover, all over buildings, names of streets. I was at the Friday Center a few years ago. It's crazy. You know, the Hoover Pavilion is at University of North Carolina. Let me turn my phone off so the sound doesn't interrupt. But, you know, those buildings are not named after Black people in my family. Those buildings are all named after the people who held. Those buildings are, and streets and centers are all named after the families that kept my family in bondage and derived their wealth from our labor, the labor of my enslaved ancestors. And that is the legacy that we carry in our bodies, in our souls, as children and descendants of enslaved Africans. And so I think that it's important for us to confront that. I think that that is a vital part of the dialogue that America needs to have in public, you know, and it's one that we don't often see people confront, you know, or have an honest discussion about. And that's really important to me, that we have an honest discussion, like, why is this? You know, why do you have all these Black folks walking around with these names that white folks also carry? And, you know, like when I meet white people with the last name Hoover, I jokingly call them cousin, you know. But what I'm really referring to is this connection, not that our name has, not just that our name has, but that our histories are intertwined, you know. When I lived in Oakland, I had there was a woman who lived across the hallway from me, and we found out that she also was a Hoover. Her grandmother was a Hoover. Now, the landlord told me later that this person was a trust fund baby, and that she paid her rent in full at the beginning of every year, the whole year's rent, which is like $18,000.
Wow. Right.
Every year, just wrote a check, boom. And I was like, because she would be gone for months. She worked on Broadway and plays and stuff as a makeup artist and a costumer. And I was like, damn, she don't make no money. How could she do that? He was like, oh, she has a trust fund. She has a trust fund. Oh, yeah, her sister lives in Palo Alto. Her sister lived in like a $6.5 million house. And so when we found out, because she brought me some of my mail one time, and she said, oh, your last name is Hoover. My grandmother's last name is Hoover. You know, I'm from North Carolina. Oh, they're from the same town my daddy was from. You know, and if the math was already laid out. Oh, you're a Hoover, I'm a Hoover. My whole Black family is mostly still in poverty. We are just now, my generation and a few people in my dad's generation emerged from poverty. So y'all are rich. The white Hoovers are for the most part rich. The Black Hoovers are still battling poverty. But you got rich off our labor.
Well, I mean, that wasn't me. That was, I'm not responsible. I mean, that happened. You know, you're going to have to get over that.
But you got that trust fund. That money, you didn't earn that money either. We earned that money for y'all, you know? And I'm not even saying give me some of the money. I would like that. But what would be meaningful to me is if those people owned up to it and said, you know what? It's not right. Wow. You know?
You're making me, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead, please.
You're making me think of about a lot of different things and how I'm thinking about this battle to censor education and to ban textbooks and to take critical race theory out of the curriculum. I'm thinking about settler colonial states. I'm thinking about what happens when we fund, you know, the state of Israel. I'm thinking about indigenous Palestinian people. I'm thinking about Native American people in the United mm-hmm. States and Canada, mass graves, uranium mining industries based on extraction for wealth consolidation. All of that is tied into these conversations. And, you know, we talk about reparations. It's like, okay, people, it's a divisive issue. It's so divisive that you got Black folks that are trying to start a movement that deals with the erasure of Native American people and the erasure of their own indigeneity in connection to the continent of Africa and people that were forcibly displaced through slavery. So it's very confusing, these conversations that are not connected to actual history. I think you're gonna be doing people a service by providing a perspective that's based on, let's just talk. Let's talk about what really happened and what's still going on.
Yeah. I mean, that's really important to me. You just said something that really touches me in a place, like really touches my heart. Like, I had my DNA done, right? For years and years and years, both of my parents have been saying, we're part Native American, we're part Native American. My mother popped up 1%. Okay. That's credible. My dad, zero. My dad is just like Welsh, English, and African. My mother is like Welsh, English, African, West African, North African, and like 1% indigenous North American. This fiction that Black people are the true native people of North America is so wrong and so ahistorical. And I think really points to this deep, deep, deep shame that a lot of Black people in America carry over our people having been enslaved. And so there, and I don't understand it, because I know who I am, right? I know who I'm descended from. I in every single way. And I've been to the motherland, and I've seen how, not just how much we physically resemble these people, but how we carry so much of that culture from West Africa back into the Americas, and we carried it and kept it alive even through our enslavement. My Aunt Mary did her graduate work and a lot of her postgraduate work, and through her career, tracing the linguistic roots of Black English, Ebonics. She's like the mother of Ebonics, Dr. Mary Rhodes Hoover, out of Stanford University. She traced the linguistic roots of Black English all the way back to the Mende and Bantu language families. And so what she found is that Black people speak English the same way that they speak French, that they speak Spanish, that they speak German, that they speak Portuguese. We apply the same lingual rules to all of those other languages. And so, like, you know, we have flexible time signatures, right? We say things like I'm finna, or I've been had, or about to, da 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 da. That translates across all languages. And we got that from our mother tongue. We're African people in the Americas, right? I also really strongly believe that because we are the first modern human beings, and we are probably more ancient than we know, that we traveled from Africa all around the world. So yeah, were there Black people here in the Americas? Of course there were.
Say that.
They were not the majority people, though. It's not right to say that we are the real Cherokee. It's just, it does, and it doesn't make any sense.
And it's not either or, it's both. And yes, there were the San people. Yes, there were the Twa, the first people to leave what now is called the continent of Africa, before it was called Africa, right? And their phenotype, their skulls are everywhere, because yeah, they're the first people to walk the whole planet.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But there are other people, there are other ethnic groups that have genesis from other parts of Earth, that have their own creation myths. And to rob those folks of their own creation story, narrative, call it a myth. But if they're saying it and they have an oral tradition, then we're going to believe that. We're going to take their word for where they come from.
Yeah. I'm not going to ever Columbus other people's history, you know. And I respect all people. I respect all living beings. And I respect all cultures. And, you know, one of the things that I got from living in Northern California, where I lived in the Bay Area, is like the home of the Ohlone people. And, you know, there's shell mounds everywhere. I've been to a bunch of powwows. I dated a woman for a long time who identified, she's still around, as multiracial. And she was Chickasaw, Cherokee, and one other thing. I'm sorry, Londa, I can't remember, but you know, she was all these things, and she embraced all of it, right? And none of it was counter to anything else. And I just really have been privileged to sit at the feet of a lot of elders, you know, and to listen to them. And I respect their histories. And I'm not here to say, you know, I've studied history a lot. You know, I'm an African. The vast majority of Black people living in the Americas today, you know, are descended from enslaved people, from enslaved Africans that were stolen away from their motherland and brought here. And like, also the people who say this are just, for the most part, Americans, right? Like the United States citizens. You don't hear people in Brazil, where they still speak Yoruba, talking about we the true Indians. Somebody would slap fire at them. You know, like you just don't hear that. They know who they are. And I don't understand this cognitive dissonance that is like erupting and wave and moving through our community, so much so that if you don't subscribe to it, people treat you like you're anti-Black, right? Like I'm dumb, like I'm stupid, because I don't want to parrot this false reality that I don't know what's going on with our people. So it's important to me in the show that we go and have this. And you know, I'm going to be respectful, but I want to go to Native American elders and talk to them and ask them questions about, had you ever heard about Black people like me being here in the old days? And I've heard that there were. So I want to get those stories out. You know, I do want to get those stories out. And I want us to have the dialogues. Let's go talk to some Moorish Americans.
Right.
You know, let's go talk to the Moors and find out what they say about the Moors landing in New York and about, you know, Manhattan being a Moorish colony. Mm-hmm. You know, let's go hear the stories. Let's put them out there so people can have critical dialogue around
it. Right, right, right. Yeah, and I want to say, you know, critical dialogue, it's not about me making somebody else's narrative wrong, you know, but I'm just saying let's be armed with as much information so that we can have a critical analysis of the truth that we're speaking. Correct. Let's have a healthy debate, you know, and let's bring people to the table that know more than we do, because in the age of social media, a lot of people are going off of hearsay and haven't done research. And if you have a platform and you talk loud, then you become an influencer, right? And influencers are doing the work of our intellectual capacity, right? Where we're not thinking critically for ourselves, we're not researching anything. Once again, you guys, Crenshaw and Shabazz, go ahead and look for that. Search that online. We'll be going to Born Free, custom motorcycle show, June 22nd. We'll be shooting. Big shout out to Ian Westmoreland, the homie Tom, DNZ Publicity Agency, and other folks that are going to be meeting along the way. I want to let people know also that June 6th, as well as June 8th, going to be doing book events at Powell Bookstore here in Portland for It Did Happen Here, as well as American Family, the story of the Shakur family. Malcolm, anything you want to say to the people before you go?
A few things, yeah. I want to say, please support us. Go to the GoFundMe. If you go to GoFundMe and you search Crenshaw and Shabazz, it'll pop up. So, because we're trying to raise this money, and so far we've been financing this thing out of our pockets, and I'm not rich. So if there's a rich person out there who wants to help, holler. Also, we can be emailed at info@crenshawandshabazz.com. Yeah, I think it's just important to support ventures like this, not just ours, but other people who are out there trying to do the critical work of bringing people together. I think there's no way that America is ever going to move out of this, like, this stage and into something better if we don't face each other with the truth and compassion and empathy to have conversations. And that's really what this is about trying to advance the conversation so that the country and the world can advance, you know? And I want to also have fun. It's a very dark, heavy issue, right? Like, this is heavy and there's a lot of heart energy around it, and it's hard to do. But also, being on motorcycles is fun, right? And people love each other. Human beings love other human beings. That is our natural state, is to love other human beings. I deeply believe that. I don't think the natural state of human beings is war. I think the natural state of human beings is unity and community. And so I'm always trying to create that and bring that and bring people together. And this is really my contribution, you know, to do that. You know, I like working locally and organizing locally. I really do. I'm very grateful to the city of Portland for providing a home and community for me when I really truly needed one. And I am grateful to be in this world, and I want to do things to bring people closer together. And so this is that effort. This is part of that effort. And this is part of my life work. And thank you, Mike, for joining me and being such a good brother to me and close friend. And I really love you. And I mean that, man, I really love you and I appreciate you and I respect you and I admire you. And this means a lot to me that we get to do this together.
Right on, brother. I feel the same. I'm very excited. And thank you for coming on Culture in Motion today. Have a great day, brother.
Peace and love.
Peace. So we're picking it up again, this conversation on culture and motion, the intersection between art, culture, music, politics, activism. I got another very special guest, my man Donnell Alexander, writer, publicist, amongst other things. Donnell, how are you doing, bro?
I'm doing really well, man. I'm very glad to be talking to you tonight.
Likewise, likewise. I've been knowing you for about, I've only known you for about 5 or 6 years. I met you in Portland.
Yeah. I feel like it was 2015 when I was doing the Conversation Project. And I remember I'd heard your name, but I hadn't really met you. I met you about the Portland Playhouse or something like that. But yeah, that was the first time we ever talked even a little bit. But over the years, I've come to respect what you do. And now I'm coming to know you better through the work we're having. So it's an interesting ride.
Yeah, man. So you're a writer, you're a director. Tell the people a little bit about the range of work that you do in the world.
Wow. Okay. Right now, I work writing about cannabis a great deal. I think the thing that people most know my work for, the thing that most people have seen is Doc Ellis and the LSD No-No, the short film about the guy who threw the no-hitter on LSD. And that's, I've dined out on that project for a decade now. Didn't make any money off of it, but it was a public radio thing. That I made like $600 off of it, but I get a lot of free drinks. That's worth something. I made like $600 because it was an NPR thing, and it just kept getting bigger and bigger. At first it was this driveway moment. That's a term they use in public radio where people don't get out of their car so they can hear the story. And then someone animated the interview, Doc telling me the story of his no-no. And the fact is, it was an hour and a half interview cut down to 4.5 minutes. And when the pictures came with it, people were super into it. A guy from New York had produced this thing barely with our awareness, my ex-partner and I, to make this thing, but it became a phenomenon. And a lot of people, if they know anything about baseball, they know about Doc Ellis and the LSD No-No. So that's the one people know. I worked for ESPN for a couple of years for the magazine, do public radio stuff, a lot of stuff with weed. I did a fellowship at USC last year about fairness in the cannabis industry. I try to be a generalist. I write a lot about race. But, that can mean almost anything. I feel that way about cannabis right now. You can write about cannabis and this, race and this. You can't really marginalize these topics like you could back in the day. So, yeah, I do a lot of different stuff.
I agree. Working
with you. We'll come back to that.
Yeah, we're about to jump into that, the whole Crenshaw and Shabazz thing and how you feel about that and what you want people to know and understand about that. But in that regard, and related to what you just said, I feel like race is such a core issue in our society that it impacts everything. You can't really talk about too much without the impact of race somehow at least intersecting in a marginal way,
Yeah, and yet we managed to. How is that? It takes a lot of effort to keep that conversation from the forefront of society. When you hear things like these institutional government organizations calling white supremacy the main threat in this country. You have to have worked really hard to not see the problem here. And we, as Americans, are very good at it. And when I say we, I mean white people are good at keeping this long-term agenda that's ingrained in society. And we're very good at saying, no, let's just go on to the next thing. It's definitely this thing we have to confront in all facets of our society. Intersectionalism scares the heck out of conservatism, because it's just about unearthing what's already there in terms of subject matter, in terms of figuring out our way, in the future.
Yeah, that's real. So we started working recently on a project called Crenshaw and Shabazz. This is a documentary series. So What brought you on board with the project?
Some parts I'm not going to talk about. I think I mentioned to you in an email that my inspiration for the involvement has unexpectedly as ever been Tyler Perry, because I'm not a huge fan of the work he does. But when you talk about the work, as artists, we don't understand these things sometimes, but the work in the 21st century means all phases of the product, not just the creating of it, but ushering it out in the world, seeing how the world views it, helping position it to come out. So I started working on this project from that end, just trying to help you guys develop the audience and the publicity for it. And as I talked, we've come into a different position where I'm actually at the helm directing. And it's been so amazing because there are facets, you know, you and I have talked about it. There are facets of you that the public doesn't necessarily know. There are facets of Malcolm, an amazing person that he wants to show off. And more than that, you guys have tools to deliver to the culture. And I just am excited about being a part of it, you know, and exploring the idea of motorcycles as a form of freedom. And who has access to that? What benefit do you get from using that freedom? You know, I feel like you guys have a lot to say in these areas that haven't always been ours as Black people to explore.
That's right. That's right. What I find interesting as I, you know, the reason I ride Harleys is because most of my uncles rode motorcycles. Three of them had Japanese bikes, Kawasaki's to be specific. One of them was an outlaw, meaning he was a one percenter. He was part of the crowd of organized motorcycle culture that belonged to outlaw motorcycle clubs. And outlaws were defined as, you know, the motorcycle world. There was a broad generalization made about the motorcycle world in the 50s after an incident in which there was some rioting in California. And it said that 99% of motorcyclists and motorcycle enthusiasts were law-abiding citizens, and the 1% were knuckleheads. We're outlaws. We're rebel rousers and troublemakers. Well, I had an uncle that when he used to roll up on his Harley and he was in a club and he had his rags, aka his cut, his vest with his patches on it, he reminded me of the gunslingers in the Westerns. And it spoke to my heart as a 5, 6, 7 year old boy in such a way that when I was able to get my first motorcycle and, you know, in my 30s, my late 30s, that was what I did, you know, and I followed in his footsteps. I joined a mostly Black outlaw club, and I rode with them for a number of years, and I learned a lot, and I'm still with it.
That's cool. Yeah. I mean, I love being introduced to it. We went to One Moto, and that was very illuminating to me. Even watching you interact with the vendors and the people there, and there's people who will be your people, I can tell, beyond race. But it was also really interesting to see the Black motorcyclists and how, you know, I can't remember the dude from SeaTac that we were talking about. I was talking to, I took a picture of him. You know, there's an aesthetic at work. Watch, it's like seeing the rodeo or some place where you're not used to seeing people of color. It's always beautiful when you see that unexpected presence.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
I think that the, you know, Black motorcyclists do have a long history, even though it hasn't been, that information isn't mainstream. But if you get on the internet and you search, you can go down a rabbit hole and you could find it. For instance, Doc, what was his name? Brother that was behind the iconic choppers, the custom bikes that were used in Easy Rider. Those were his designs, you know?
Wow.
There's a couple of short documentaries about him. Jesse James from West Coast Choppers actually did a feature on him. There was a Black woman. And you guys, I'm going to encourage you. I should have pulled the names up before I started talking. But, you know, there's a Black woman who rode her Harley across the country at a time when, you know, it wasn't safe for Black motorcyclists to be doing such a thing. And, you know, I think that we need to consider Black motorcycle culture in the same context that we considered a lot of other historical representations of Black people in areas that were thought to be predominantly white.
Right.
You know, baseball, rock music. Cowboy culture.
Yeah, erasure is definitely an issue. I didn't know that much about the erasure and cowboy culture. Have you seen the Sidney Poitier Harry Belafonte movie?
Bucking the Preacher.
Yeah,
I grew up watching that, man.
So, you know, there was an unstated rule about showing Black men on horses in Westerns.
No.
And, you know, that's, yeah, there's a sort of power represented that wasn't supposed to be going out into the world. I since I've been talking to you guys and thinking about the motorcycle culture, I think about what it means to have the image of a black man on a motorcycle. It's not that different from a horse. And I don't think it was intentionally restrained. You know, I was hoping in for preparation for our coverage of your great trip in the story, I want us to see The Black Six again. You remember that one? The blaxploitation film? It's a motorcycle flick.
Really? The Black Six.
It's populated with, I think Mean Joe Green is in it. There's a bunch of football players in it. And I saw it as a teenager. It's one of those things you know isn't good, but you love it.
Yeah, it's like a train wreck. Yeah.
It's a little bit, but it's also the intentionality. And I think it is that thing about seeing black men on motorcycles. It has the connotations that are not that different from the black man on a horse, you know? And, you know, Ian, our director of photography, and I have been talking about how we want to shoot you guys. And yeah, that comes up a lot, and at least in my mind, you know, the inherent heroism, you know, that you get from a black man on a motorcycle. You know, I was going to use the word a punk, and I don't know what world we're in terms of how we're regarding sexuality or whatever. I want to say something that's fair, but you don't have the person who's looked at as, what do you want to call it? The loser is not on the motorcycle, you know. Right.
The wimp isn't on
the wimp. Yeah, and I know it's a big, great, big subject, and you know I hope visually we can get at least some of it across. We got some surprises we haven't even told you and Malcolm yet.
Okay. Well, one more time for the people. This was mentioned earlier in the show when we had Malcolm on, but if people want to find a link that will have a video and maybe how people can support the project online, how should they do that?
Well, I think that's such a great question, because I'm actually not very satisfied by how people can get to it. But you know what you have on the Crenshaw and Sabaz website on your page about the site works very well at showing you what it's about. But the GoFundMe page is that you can check out if you use the hashtag Crenshaw and Sabaz. And you search on Instagram, you should find some stuff. We're adding stuff every day. I know you've got that big event in Minnesota on Friday. We're really looking forward to that. So, you know, we'll be having tweets and Instagram content under that hashtag, Crenshaw and Sabaz.
Word. Thank you so much for coming on, Donnell. It's been a pleasure. I look forward to everything that we're up to. Have a good night. Be safe.
Thanks, man. Thanks for having me.
All right. Thank you. You've been listening to Culture in Motion, and look out for Crenshaw and Sabaz, and search that online, Crenshaw and Sabaz. One love, y'all.
Connect with your favorite community radio station on social media.
Our Facebook page is facebook.com/kboomradio.
And follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/kboo.
We also have a YouTube channel at youtube.com/kboo radio.
We also provide content to the free music archive.
An interactive library of high quality legal audio downloads.
That's at freemusicarchive.org/curator/KBOO.
You can find all of this and more on the KBOO website, kboo.fm.
Thanks for listening.
Did you know that KBOO is streaming live on the web? Well, you do now. Just type www.kboo.fm, click on Listen Live, and you've got us. Just another example of how KBOO 90.7 FM Portland works for you. It's your community radio.
destinations at. Planning routing. Two. Hackney Down Station. Hackney.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
Lie down, all in the ground, I'd root that mountain down, and I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Tune in to KBOO Monday mornings at 9 for the Old Mole Variety Hour, your source for radically democratic news, views, reviews, and interviews, stories of ordinary and extraordinary people working to root down the oppressive institutions of capitalism. That's the Old Mole Variety Hour, Monday mornings at 9.
KBOO Radio is hiring. We are currently accepting applications for the position of Membership Coordinator. The Membership Coordinator is responsible for planning and developing KBOO's fundraisers and on-air membership drives, data entry, working with major donors, direct mail campaigns, and community outreach. This position is 25 hours per week.